Hello and welcome to Health Equity Matters HIV Australia podcast. My name is Harrison, and in today's episode, we're turning our focus to South Australia and a very special project called Writing Ourselves In. Led by Thorn Harbour Health, this year-long initiative is documenting and celebrating the history of HIV in South Australia. The project is inviting people living with HIV to get involved in a range of ways, through monthly workshops for older community members supported by younger people living with HIV, or through the sharing of photos, flyers, and memories that help tell this incredible story. With all of these contributions coming together in a professionally published book due for release in 2026. To tell us more about this project, I'm joined by Dr. Nikki Sullivan, Project Development Manager at Thorn Harbour Health. Together, we're going to reflect on why this work matters, how stories are both being collected and crafted, and the impact this project hopes to have for people living with HIV and the wider community in South Australia. Nikki, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today. How are you?
You, Harrison, I'm fantastic, and I'm so happy to be here to talk about the project.
Oh, it's our pleasure having you. So to begin with, for those not familiar yet with Writing Ourselves In, tell us a little bit more about the project and how it all came about.
Yeah, well, I guess it came about because we were working with our older positive community members to do some sort of storytelling activities. And what I realized as we were doing that is that, of course, you know, our community members have really, really important stories to tell. But oftentimes those stories are, you know, about people's personal lived experience. And there's not a lot about the context really in which these experiences occur. And I suppose as somebody who's really interested in history, I felt as if we need to place these stories in a context. We need to know more about why people's experiences unfolded in the ways that they have. You know, what's the relationship between a sort of a cultural context or a milieu, if you like, and individual lived experience? And so we applied to the Office for Aging Well for a positive aging fellowship grant, and we were successful. And so that's how it all started.
That's incredible. And I mean, just hearing, you know, how it all came about is really, really wonderful. And it kind of got me thinking as well, like, what do I know about the history of HIV in South Australia? And to be completely honest with you, Nikki, like as a New South Waldian, not a whole lot. Like, can you tell us, what do we know about the history of HIV in South Australia and the context that people found themselves in?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's a really good question. And it's an important question because I think so often when we're talking about histories of marginalised communities of any kind, really, in Australia, we tend to focus on the East Coast. So, you know, New South Wales, Sydney, Melbourne tend to have produced much more work when we're looking at these kinds of histories than is the case in South Australia. And having lived in those other states and cities, coming back to South Australia, I became really aware that, yeah, there just weren't publications around LGBTIQA histories, HIV histories. And it's interesting, you know, for those of us, I guess, who are old enough to have been there at the time, you forget often that not everybody was there and that not everybody knows. I mean, I don't know these histories inside out either, but I mean, I think for younger people in our communities, they're often very unfamiliar with what went on in the 80s or the 90s because they either weren't born or they were children or whatever. But also, I think that the people who were there just assume that other people know. And yeah. And then I think the other thing to add to that is that the people who were there are now, you know, we're all getting older, right? So it's like if we don't capture these histories now, then perhaps they're never going to be told, or they're never going to be told by the people who lived through them. And I guess that's what's important to me. While this is not a project that is telling personal stories per se, I think it's important that the people who investigate this history, and they will be doing it in really sort of formalized ways that I'll talk about later, It is important that that work is carried out by people who were there at the time, supported by younger people, I think, so that you get that intergenerational exchange. But yeah, I think oftentimes South Australia doesn't, it sort of gets a little bit forgotten. And now I'm a South Australian, it's important to me that it isn't.
Yeah, and I think it's important, nationally as well. Like, I can imagine a situation, having grown up in New South Wales and not also being very familiar with the history given where I grew up, out in the western suburbs. Like, I wasn't really across the history. But one of the things that was stark when I reflect on what you're saying is that when I was able to kind of get into the city and get connected with, at the time it was Akon, that was there ready to go. And so I think there's also something you mentioned before, it's really important for the younger generation to have access to and connection to those stories. And the fact that, that has only been done through, oral, person to person and not necessarily done in this way is really incredible and really invaluable. What do you think this will mean, or what is this already meaning for people who are involved actively in the project, who are living with HIV and have grown up in South Australia?
I mean, I think it means lots of things. In some ways, some of the people that we're working with, I know there are moments when this is really difficult because it is going back to and looking at historical material from a period that was incredibly traumatic for so many people in our communities. But I think also what it reminds some of those people is how incredible the work that they did was. In the midst of absolute trauma, people came together in ways that were just, to me, it's still mind-boggling. I don't think we do it quite this well right now. And I think it's empowering. It's empowering for them because, they remember, yes, we did this. We are here now. People can live their lives with HIV the way that they do now because of the work that we did, because of the struggles that we lived through. And I think also they get to reflect on the skills that they developed. Because if you think about those really, really early years of the epidemic, most of the people who came to be involved really didn't begin with a whole lot of sort of skills around, engaging with government, setting up organizations, running massive volunteer programs, but they learned those skills because they had to. And that's an incredible story, because it reminds us all as well that we can do this if we pull together. We don't always have to, look for things that are already established. We can set up things together. We have done that in the past from nothing. And if you look now, 40 odd years down the track at some of those organizations that were set up in the early days, like ACON in New South Wales, but in South Australia, it was the AIDS Council of South Australia, which unfortunately we no longer have. But we do have Thorn Harbour Health, which, is that's fantastic. But yeah, when you look at that growth, it's phenomenal. I can't think of another example. Of a community or communities coming together to build something that has been so influential, so incredibly important in queer people's and HIV positive people's lives as those organizations.
And at a time as well where, like, and around an issue that required, fighting and changing public discourse and opinion on multiple fronts. It's not just about HIV, it's also about, queer people being degenerates and, having to go up against, really large institutions that had an interest in us not authoring our own histories and not existing. Your reflections on what that process means for people living with HIV who are a part of the project is really beautiful, actually, because I think that there's got to be a sense of pride, I think, from participants, being able to reflect on all of those incredible moments and memories.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, the benefit then for younger people involved in the project is that they become aware of archives. So part of this project is actually a capacity building sort of element that helps people to identify where are these histories? How do we go find them? Because it's not as simple as just like, oh, I'll just go read a book. Where are these sort of primary documents or these primary source materials? How do you access them? How do you interpret them? How do you sort of put them together so that you fit the jigsaw puzzle together, if you like? And what can we draw from that in terms of, activism now? How do we shape our presence and our futures by drawing on our pasts? We don't just collect history in order to say, oh yeah, isn't that great that happened? Let's put it in that box there and leave it there. And every now and again, we'll just go and have a look at it, to reminisce. It's not for that, from my perspective. It is there to inform what we do now and what we continue to do. We should never forget what we've done in the past. And we also never know when we're going to be in a position where we're going to have to take on some of the same fights again. But even if they're not exactly the same fights, I think, these are histories of activism and really successful activism that we can draw on and that would be really beneficial to us now and moving forwards.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I immediately as you're saying that, I'm kind of flicking through a few of those, prime examples of protest and advocacy. I remember, I'm trying to think of where it was situated, but I remember people lifting, hoiking themselves up above a key office building and, scribbling in lipstick, messages of protest. I think you're so right about, also, the tools that sit within that history that we can all benefit from today. And you're right, we don't really know what the future holds. And being able to pass those tools and knowledge on to the younger generation is really, really special and really incredible. And I suppose that kind of leads us really nicely into the process. So I imagine that building such a history takes time and it takes a few steps. What can you tell us a little bit more about how the project's being implemented and rolled out and what the process of building this history is looking like?
So, I mean, I think the challenge for us is that we've got funding for a year. And, for anybody who's a researcher, you don't write a book in a year. So it might be a booklet, but whatever it is, it will be a print on demand, substantial story. That is the beginning of the story. It won't be the definitive stories. Well, there isn't one, is there? And so what we're doing is we're working with a core group of older people living with HIV, bringing in external consultants who support them to develop skills to, first of all, think about what is historical research? How is historical research different to personal storytelling? What does it mean to reference things so that other people can follow your footsteps if they want to? How do you use materials from the past? What kinds of permissions do you have to seek, and so on? They'll also be getting some training around oral histories. How do you do oral histories? Again, I know people often think you just turn up and you turn your record on your phone and you do it like that, but there's a lot of, it is actually something you need to learn to do well in order to for it to be effective. What are archives? Where are they? Where are they held? How do you access them? Can you just walk into a library and go, I want to look at such and such? And the answer is no, it's not that easy. How do you search, records? I mean, in lots of collecting institutions, record keeping is not as great as we might expect it to be. And so sometimes you have to be really creative in order to find what you want to find. It's not as simple as just putting in the keywords that might first come to mind. So doing that kind of work, and then thinking about things like how do you tell a story? What is a narrative arc? How are you going to organize this material? Are you going to do it thematically? Are you going to do it chronologically? So there's a whole lot of sort of skills that I think, I am by training a researcher and writer. So, and what I realize when I'm looking at the development of this project is how much I take for granted and what it is then we have to ensure that we do to bring people in, to support people to develop those skills, and then to support them to implement them. I know sometimes it can sound really dry if you're not a sort of a historian. Oh, archives can sound like really boring places, but I mean, they are actually like absolute treasure troves. And oftentimes you'll go into an archive looking for something in particular, and you'll end up with a box of something. And the thing that you thought you were looking for, it's there, but it's not that exciting. But you come across all of these other things that are just, absolute jewels. There are also things like Trove, which is the newspaper archive. So Trove is completely free. It's online. You can search for anything in any state or territory in Australia and any newspaper that's been digitized. It's an incredible resource, but a lot of people who are not researchers don't know about it. So it's, Hansard is another one. I want to know, and I want to talk to our project participants about what were the kinds of debates that were going on in Parliament around the emergence of this epidemic? What were people saying? How were the parliamentarians or the politicians responding? Who was supportive? Who wasn't? Where were they turning to for advice? All of this is in Hansard. Again, for most people who, they don't know these resources exist. So it's making people aware of where all of these sort of scattered bits of primary information are, these sort of primary sources, and then how do you go looking them effectively so that you're not spending, 10 times as much time as you need to be. And then when you start to pull out these things that interest you, how do you put them together so that they cohere into something that makes sense to other people? So that there's a lot to learn. But I think it's an incredibly exciting and empowering process. And yeah, I'm hoping that everybody will come along on that journey with us. And as you said, there are different roles that people will play. So, somebody might decide, look, I'm really interested in images. I'm really interested in searching for photographs from that period. So they'll be looking at things like copyright, all of the things that go with image use. Somebody else might say, oh, I love Hansard. I just want to spend my time immersed in Hansard. And then other people might say, look, I don't want to do those workshops because I've actually already got some skills, or because I'm not free at that time, but I really want to be part of the conversation. And so we've got the face-to-face workshops. We've also got evening online sort of meetings that are more just conversational. And people can dip in and out in any way they want. They could be interviewed if they want to, or they could just send us emails and go, I've got these documents, these little flyers that we put together in 1985 when I was part of this small group. And people don't have to live in South Australia anymore, so they just have to have been in South Australia at some point during this history.
It's a really, really important call to action. If we're working with community, particularly people living with HIV, who potentially may have lived in South Australia in the past, it's really important for us to share the news about writing ourselves in so that we can hopefully bring those people into the conversation. And so, Nikki, what has the response from community been like to the project?
It's been mixed. I mean, most people, first of all, sort of go, oh, yeah, I've got something. I've got something I want to add to this. Sometimes people are a little bit afraid and go, oh, gosh, I don't know how to do that. Or they might think, oh, yeah, archives, I don't really know what they are, but they don't sound very interesting. But I think once you sort of sit down and say to people, these are our histories. Like, do we want people to know about them in the future? Are we proud of the work that people did? Do we only want this story or these stories of these histories to be told from the perspectives of certain states? Because, of course, while there was a federal response to HIV, there were also state-specific responses, and how they articulate is really different. So, yeah, I mean, the situation in South Australia is very different to how it's unfolded in, say, New South Wales. And I think we often also don't know about, you know, what were the organisations and the groups that emerged and disappeared and along the way. And people will often know about really small things that have disappeared from sight for most other people. So I do find that people have gotten excited and gone, oh gosh, you know, I was part of this thing that I thought nobody would ever talk about again, which was an activist group or whatever that really was only around for about 6 months, but we did this, this, and this. And so we have been getting some really amazing photographs come to us through emails and things. And, you know, we'll be jumping up and down in the office going, this is so amazing. And then everything like that that sort of comes in just opens up a whole another set of questions about, well, who are these people? What did they go on to do? And so generally, I think once people get over, you know, for those people who are doing the sort of core work, I think it's initially it was a bit, oh gosh, this seems big and strange. But I think, yeah, it's now become really exciting for everybody. And I'm really, really grateful to be here to talk about this because, as you said, you know, a lot of, well, Adelaide's a place that historically queer people in particular have moved away from often in their youth because, you know, the big city lights were very compelling. And so a lot of people who may have been involved in the HIV response in the early days or in their youth have then gone off to other states. And we really want those voices in here too. So yes, please, please respond to us if there's anything that you can add, it would be fantastic.
And we're absolutely going to share the link to the Facebook page and information about how you can also get stories to Nikki and the team at Thorn Harbour Health. I can imagine I would probably be one of those people that, you know, if we were talking about this, would immediately, my mind would race in a million different directions and be like, oh, where do we start? What do we do? But I can hear, and just the way that you've guided us through the project, I can totally see how that would be quickly soothed and I would feel much more in control because, you know, just going back to what you said a little while earlier, it really kind of does center around the story and contextualizing the story and placing a person's story in what was happening around them. And I think that that's a really wonderful way of, I suppose, maybe I'm going to use terms that make sense to me, like de-escalating me, but, you know, make it a little bit more accessible, a little bit more achievable. And you've got me excited about going to archives and I would probably be that person who would talk about, oh, Hansard, let's find out what Polly's are saying. So yeah, it sounds wonderful. It sounds really exciting. Has any story theme or just off the back of what you were saying about photos, has anything stood out to you so far that you can share us, like share
yeah.
with the audience?
Yeah, look, I think one of the things that stands out, it's less a story than a phenomenon, which, you know, at some level, I guess we're all aware of in the abstract. And that is that once you start talking to people, you find out how many people have got boxes of things under their beds. I mean, like not boxes of papers, posters, you know, meeting notes. I mean, this is the thing that's really striking me. And as somebody who used to work in the glam sector, galleries, libraries, archives, and museum sector. I have been aware for some time that people keep things, but that they don't know what to do with them. And yeah, you know, we recently, through this project, became aware that there's a large number of boxes being held some in a particular place that are full of. We don't even know what they are because the people who put them there have forgotten what they were in, what was in them, but they were part of an HIV organization here. That now we've just got to go and get those boxes and go through them. And that's part of what the group is going to do is to look through those boxes. But then what it makes you ask is how many people have got something like that under their beds or in their cupboards or whatever. And I think the answer is probably most of us, in fact. And it's, I mean, to me, this is a really important question. Recently, somebody here passed away and their family, who they'd been quite estranged from, came in and basically cleared the house. And what this, and I've seen this happen time and time again, and what this sort of reminds me always is like, these things are precious. We need to know, we need to be talking amongst ourselves about, where are the collecting organizations? Where do we need to ensure this material goes so that it's kept safe? Because a lot of these things, once they're lost, they're lost. They're never going to be replaced. You can't replace them. And oftentimes, you know, people produce things in such small numbers. When you think of those old Xeroxed, you know, little flyers, when you look at the zines and things that people were producing,
And
they
the
were
screen
produced in really
printing as
small
well.
numbers. Yeah,
Oh, sorry, just to say, like the
absolutely.
screen printing, I remember seeing the, the early, because, like even getting screen printing was really expensive. I remember, was it Brent Mackey who said to me once that when he first did his workshop advertisements at Acorn, he was cutting things out of magazines, like words, and sticking them down together because that's all that they had access to at the time, you know? Yeah,
That's right. You
wow.
didn't, you know, people couldn't produce things on a laptop in the way that we do now. And those things are just incredible things. And they're also, when you go to an archive and you get to actually hold this real thing in your hand that somebody has cut out letters from and stuck it on a piece of paper, there is nothing. Well, I mean, I don't know if it makes everybody feel like this, but that stuff just makes my heart sing, you know. It's like, this is everything. This has been produced in a room with a bunch of people who have passion and who want to change the world. And there's nothing that makes you feel like holding those things and looking at those things. And yeah, they don't, you know, they don't, they, and for me, what's most important is that they are produced by everyday people. You know, they're not these sort of high art things that are produced in some extremely, I don't know,
Like resource
esteemed
heavy and
setting.
ordained.
Yeah, they're
Yeah.
just produced by people who come together because they really care about something. And yeah, we need to preserve those things. So I guess, rather than a story, what has become really apparent to me yet again, is that, yeah, there are all these things. Like, let's come together and work out what we do. We know there are some fantastic collecting organizations like AQUA, Australian Queer Archives, but there are also collecting organizations in each state and territory. But yeah, we need to make sure that we keep them and that they are accessible to our communities. That's the other thing, you know, when you're approaching collecting organizations, you need to make sure that they are going to make these things accessible, not that they're going to lock them away from our communities, because that can happen too.
That's a really important point as well, because I think a lot of people kind of not in the know around like how museums and, archiving organizations work, that can be a reality. Like, have you faced challenges with getting access to community history?
Absolutely. So, in another role that I had before I worked for Thorn Harbour Health, I was doing an exhibition on activism over the years, and I was trying to access an incredible collection of feminist badges that had been made in the 70s and 80s, and of which I had actually been in some of those workshops making some of those badges. They'd been donated to a collecting organization that I won't name, but trying to get access to those badges, I could go and look at them, but what I wanted to do was to scan them and to make big prints of them and put them on the wall in the gallery as part of this exhibition that I was creating. And that they were sort of arguing that no, there was copyright issues, because then people could scan them, you know, they could take photos of them on their phone and reproduce them. But the thing is, these were never made to be owned by anybody. You know what I mean? They were made in a context of collectivity. They were made, you know, like, by the people, for the people. And it felt to me as if, and I understand why collecting organizations have the sort of regulatory mechanisms that they do in order to preserve things. But it seemed to me like there was a real tension between, you know, the ethos in which they were created and the ethos in which they were now being preserved. And so, yeah, I think there's lots of things to talk about and think about around that if we are interested in preserving our histories. And I think now, you know, in the present, we now produce so much material and so much digitally born material that I think we now should be thinking about what are we wanting to do with that moving forwards, because there's a whole lot of questions that go with the preservation of digital born materials that we haven't, you know, that libraries and things are dealing with, but that we as a community are not really necessarily thinking massively about.
Yeah, we really need to think about preserving the present, you know, so that we have that history. Nikki, this has been such a wonderful podcast. I suppose I just wanted to kind of close out our conversation today by talking a little bit about what this project has meant to you personally, but also what your hopes are for the future of the project beyond this booklet and the Writing Ourselves In project.
Yeah. I mean, for me, the project is part of a bigger piece of work that we are doing with PLHIV in South Australia, but primarily with older PLHIV, because that's what a couple of our grants have been around. But, you know, that's not to say we can't include everybody living with HIV and also everybody who's been affected by it. So we also, for example, have a group of people involved who had a loved one who died very early on in the epidemic, and who really want to, I guess, carry that person's legacy forward by being involved in this project. So projects like this for me are open to, you know, anybody who's ever been affected by HIV. I guess what I want to come out of it is I want us as communities, as queer communities and HIV positive communities, to recognize the power of, you know, the power that we have when we pull together, to see what it is we've done, what it is we can do right now by actually retelling these histories, how it is that we can then work together to, you know, both in the present and to shape our futures. I want to see these projects as at once, you know, preserving and celebrating our histories, but also as, you know, community strengthening practices. I personally think making is about connection. It's about building strength and connection and community and resilience, and as much as it is about producing the output. So yeah, that I just want to see us all grow together, both in strength and knowledge and commitment to one another, I suppose, and to recognize that we're different, we have different histories, but we can pull together around things that matter.
That brings us to the end of our podcast today. Nikki, thank you so, so much for your time and your insights and for sharing information about Writing Ourselves In. It's such an important project, and I cannot wait to see the book launched in 2026.
Thank you for having me and for helping us to sort of get the word out there about this. And yeah, I'm really excited about it too, even though I'm a little bit daunted about the work, but I think it's going to be fantastic. Yeah.
Brilliant.